die.
Manju was distressed to see her mother curled up, making a cave of herself, though she knew better than to ask why. Instead, she said,
"Not like you, Mummy, sitting still."
Said the next day, handing over a steaming teacup,
"I'm tired too, from my exams."
Said the next day,
"I'll copy this poem over and do it nicely."
Asha had smeared the ink with her tears. That evening, when Asha pulled her head out of the blanket, she found her ode to low expectations neatly printed, laminated, and hanging from a tack on the wall. Although Manju attributed her mother's grief entirely to a secret heartache, Asha's heart at 40 was stubborn and knowing. Her brain was the troublesome thing. When not reflecting on the cause of past failures, she brooded on the smallest of slights. A police officer who no longer returned her phone calls. Rina, a Shiv Sena colleague who had a special puja and failed to invite her. The normal Asha would have been happy not to visit Rina, who was grumpy and had the face of a cow. But in her current mood, small affronts were bundled with larger disappointments and became a body of evidence. Something bright in her had been eclipsed. Asha had always prized her competitiveness, a quality that she'd failed to pass on to her children. Perhaps because they lacked it, she had valued it more in herself. But over time, the compulsion to win could become self-deceiving. Instead of admitting that she was making little progress, she had invented new definitions of success. She had felt herself moving ahead just a little every time other people failed. She had outflanked the Husseins, for one, and Mr. Cumblay in a way. But the facts of her days had barely changed. She was still living with a drunken husband in a cramped hut by a sewage lake. Her vanity, a quality she had passed on to all three children, was being undermined. She had failed to crack the code of the wider city, while at home, many of her neighbors had started to loathe her. Anuwadians agreed upon the moment when their respectful wariness of Asha had turned to vibrant dislike. It was during her attempt to capitalize on what they feared, that in 2010 or 2011, the airport slums would start being raised. Since it was election season, and airport slum dwellers were known to vote, some politicians were still talking about fighting the demolition. But plans were well underway. A small part of the cleared acreage would be used to serve the expanding airport, and the rest would be leased on the open market. In place of 30-odd slums, there would be more hotels, shopping malls, office complexes, perhaps a theme park. The airport clearance would roughly follow the state's slum redevelopment scheme. Under it, private developers were granted rights to build on slum land only if they agreed to construct apartments for those slum dwellers who could prove they'd lived in their huts since 2000. Corruption in the scheme was endemic. Organized crime syndicates had become major players. But the program had overt limitations as well. Although in the previous 2 years 122,000 huts had been demolished, two-thirds of the affected families hadn't lived in their huts long enough to qualify for rehousing. So they had crowded into other slums or built new slums on the outskirts of the city. The general failure of Mumbai's slum clearance efforts made removing the airport slums even more important. The job was manageable in scale and outsized in resonance. It would signify to the world that Indian leaders were making headway on their goal of a slum-free Mumbai. It irked Asha that officials saw the slums simply as monuments to backwardness.
"And if they need space at the airport so badly," she said one day, "why don't they bulldoze the hotels?"
But luxury hotels were not perceived as the problem. Swimming pools and lawns would be preserved. So what was she supposed to do, as a leader of one of the eyesores said to be holding back the fortunes of a nation? Unite her neighbors in some fruitless opposition? It had seemed to her more realistic to pursue her private ambitions and make some money. She had identified an opening in land speculation, of which there was much at Anuwadi lately. The apartments promised to displaced airport slum dwellers would be tiny, 269 square feet, but would have running water, which made them a valuable asset in a city starved of affordable formal housing. Hence, overcity people had been buying up shacks in the slums and concocting legal papers to show that they were long-time Anuwadi residents. Most of the speculators intended to use the rehabilitation flats as rental or investment properties.
The flat I'll get will be worth 10 times what I paid for this place, said the businessman who bought Abdul's storage hut. A small-time politician named Papa Panchal had secured a large block of huts by the sewage lake on behalf of a major developer, hiring thugs on commission to persuade the occupants to sell. Asha had anticipated her own commission when she arranged for a middle-aged hotel supplier to buy the hut of an illiterate young mother of three named Geeta. The fake papers, showing that the businessman was a veteran slum dweller, had come out nicely. Then Geeta began to have second thoughts at high volume. Such shouting, up and down the slum lanes. Asha had tricked her. Her children would be out on the pavement. Geeta refused to leave her hut and tried to register a complaint with the police. Asha handled the police end of things, of course. The problem arose when the businessmen sent a gang of drunken men to expedite Geeta's exit, on a Sunday afternoon when all of Anawadi was on hand to watch. Asha dispatched her son Rahul to supervise as the men dragged the tiny, flailing Geeta out into the slum lanes by her hair, dumped her belongings into the sewage lake, called her a whore, and poured kerosene over her last bag of rice. Sobbing, Geeta's young children had crouched to pick up the soiled rice grains, one by one. Bad visuals. Damaging to the stature of a slumlord, especially one who had been seen sitting at home, face hard as a knuckle, while the violence in the slum lanes had transpired. Ever since that Sunday, the whispers of her neighbors had trailed Asha like jet streams.
"She's become like an animal in her greed," said a Nepali woman, putting her hand to her mouth. "Always she was sly, but now we know there is no one she won't hurt for money," said a Tamil woman. "She probably made 10,000 rupees in the end," said Zerunisa.
This hurt the most when it got back to Asha. 10,000 would have been tremendous, would have made up for the lost reputation. Instead, the businessman had stiffed her on the commission. It was an experience so disheartening that when another corrupt and powerful person approached her, promising that, this time, her efforts would be rewarded with a share of the proceeds, she was skeptical. And the moment you think you're going to live more, you're going to die. She firmly held this position of pessimism until the day she saw she would be living more, which was the day the government check cleared the bank. The idea that secured her family's future was not her own. It belonged to an administrator named Bimrao Gaikwad at the Maharashtra Department of Education. His charge was to implement in Mumbai an ambitious central government program, supported by foreign aid, called Sarva Shiksha Abhiyan. Its aim was to make elementary education universal, bringing tens of millions of child laborers, girls, and disabled children to school for the first time. In newspaper interviews, Gaikwad spoke of his search for unschooled children and his hope of giving them the sort of education that would lift them out of poverty. His less public ambition was to divert federal money to himself. Working with community development officials across the city, he found frontmen to receive government funds in the name of educating children. Then he and his colluders would divvy up the spoils. Later, Asha wished that she had come to the attention of Gaikwad because of her intelligence or even her looks. But his interest was based on something more mundane, the fact that she had a non-profit organization. In 2003, another man with another scheme had set up the non-profit for her, promising a city sanitation contract that had failed to materialize.
"Properly registered?" Gaikwad wanted to know.
"Yes, properly."
And on that basis, she was chosen to help him defraud the central government's most important effort to improve the lives of children. Government officials prepared documents attesting that for several years, her nonprofit had been running 24 kindergartens for poor children. The government would pay her 4.7 lakhs, or more than $10,000, for this fictitious work. More money would come later in the year for her supposed management of 9 bridge schools for former child laborers. From this windfall, Asha would write checks to a long list of names that Gaikwad provided, theoretically teachers and assistants at the schools. What business was it of hers to ask who they were? Her business was to hand-deliver 20,000 rupees in cash to Bimrao Gaikwad, plus 5,000 rupees to the community development official who had helped to fix the contract. In the first year, Asha wouldn't make big money after all the payoffs, but Gaekwad had assured her that there would be more money in the years ahead. A minor hitch occurred when the first installment of government money, 429,000 rupees, showed up in the bank account of the moribund non-profit. The checks to be dispersed required a co-signer, but the neighbor whom Asha had named long ago as the non-profit secretary was in a state.
"Will we be rich?" the woman asked, and then tearfully, "What if we get caught?"
She resisted signing the checks, so Asha fired her and appointed a more compliant secretary. The checks went out, and the government officials got their cash. Triumphant, Asha felt confirmed in a suspicion she'd developed in her years of multi-directional, marginally profitable enterprise. Becoming a success in the great rigged market of the Overcity required less effort and intelligence than getting by day-to-day in the slums. The crucial things were luck and the ability to sustain two convictions, that what you were doing wasn't all that wrong in the scheme of things, and that you weren't all that likely to get caught.
"Of course it's corrupt,"
Asha told the deferential new secretary of the non-profit.
"But is it my corruption? How can anyone say I am doing the wrong when the big people did all the papers, when the big people say that it's right?"
The new secretary nodded at Asha's analysis, but ever since she had co-signed the checks, her mouth had been slightly tight. How could she argue? Asha was her mother.
"Now you don't have to do a real job once your studies are finished,"
Asha told Manju of the empire of schools they were pretending to be running.
"You'll take it over from me. I'll have to put your name down as the person in charge anyway, since all these schools are supposed to be run by someone with an education."
Although Manju was troubled by this legacy, she wasn't about to refuse the second-hand computer that soon came through the door. Mina had been the hot resister of daughterly responsibilities, not she. Asha also provided a dial-up internet connection, which Rahul used to join Facebook, though his interest in social networking receded when his red Honda motorcycle arrived. Manju loved her computer, as did the children she had taught in her slum school. They popped in regularly to contemplate its splendor. The children still called her teacher and looked at her expectantly, unwilling to believe that their education was over. But the schools Asha and Manju were pretending to run made the income derived from a real school unnecessary. Manju had recently memorized a plot summary of Dr. Faustus, which told of an ultimate reckoning. The moment when a person who wanted to be the supreme person discovered that the payment for a good life, badly acquired, had come due. Though this Christian hell was something she couldn't quite picture, she felt that punishment might be in the offing. One quiet evening, shortly before the day on which she graduated from college, she looked up from her keyboard, alarmed. There were five eunuchs at the door. The eunuchs were nothing like the lithe and beautiful one who had once mesmerized her in the temple by the sewage lake. These she-males had hairy hands, mustache traces, and a practice of coming to the doors of families who'd had good luck and throwing down a curse to reverse it. She was terrified, and the eunuchs felt bad, making her tremble like that. They had come on different business. Asha being the most powerful person they knew, they hoped she would help them register to vote in the election, a week away. Like most Anawadians, they wanted to be part of the exhilarating moment when politics was forced from its cryptic quarters and brought into the open air. The parliamentary elections would be the largest exercise of democracy in the history of the world. Nearly 500 million people standing in line to vote for their representatives in Delhi, who would in turn select the prime minister. The parliamentarian who would represent Anawadians was hardly in doubt. It would be the incumbent from the Congress Party, Priya Dutt, a kind, unassuming woman who personified two historical weaknesses of the Indian electorate, for filmy people and for legacies. Her parents had been Bollywood superstars, and her father had held the parliamentary seat before her. The previous week, a Congress Party truck had pulled up outside Anawadi, and workers unloaded 8 stacks of concrete sewer covers. A crowd amassed on the road, excited at the pre-election gift. Thanks to Priya Dutt's party, the slum lanes would have no more open sewers. A few days later, the Congress Party workers returned in the truck. Instead of installing the sewer covers, they reclaimed them. The covers were needed in one of the district's larger slums, where the prop might influence a greater number of voters. Older Anawadians laughed as they watched the truck depart. The blatancy was refreshing. The eunuchs, who were migrants from Tamil Nadu, saw little difference among the political parties, but they were eager to vote nonetheless. Their problem was that district election officials sometimes failed to process registration forms submitted by migrants and other reviled minorities. While Asha and her husband had voter cards and ID numbers that allowed them each 2 votes in 2 different precincts, many non-Maharashtrians in Anawadi had yet to secure their 1 vote. Zerunisa and Karam Hussein were local record holders in disenfranchisement, having spent 7 years trying unsuccessfully to register to vote. To the excluded Anawadians, political participation wasn't cherished because it was a potent instrument of social equality. The crucial thing was the act of casting a ballot. Slum dwellers, who were criminalized by where they lived and the work they did living there, were in this one instance equal to every other citizen of India. They were a legitimate part of the state, if they could get on the rolls. The tallest eunuch bowed toward Asha, then crouched at her feet.
"Teacher," the eunuch said, "1 year ago we went to register at the office, but still we have not received our voting cards. We have done the needfuls, but then nothing. The election is so near. Will you take our forms and give them to the right people and make them give us a vote?"
Asha picked up a hand mirror. The eunuch coughed.
"Can you help, teacher?"
Manju furrowed her brow. Her mother was acting as if the eunuchs were not even there. Asha picked up a tub of moisturizing cream and rubbed her face slowly. She poured talc on her palms and massaged it onto her cheeks. She was getting ready to go someplace else.
"What? Putting on makeup?"
hissed one of the eunuchs to another, too loudly. But in the someplace for which Asha seemed already to have departed, she didn't hear. Asha had quit being slum boss. She was done with politics. Done with disenfranchised eunuchs and all the other inhabitants of Anawadi. Finished with all these small deals that keep me running here and there. Whether the Husseins went to prison, or an entire slum lane expired of TB, or Fatima's ghost got bored with her hauntings and took it upon herself to clean the toilets which badly required it. Not of interest. Asha might have to live in this slum for the time being, but she was a member of the Overcity now, the director of a charitable trust, a philanthropic organization with a city vendor number, and maybe, someday soon, foreign donors. She was a respectable woman in the land of make-believe, who also happened to be late for a date. "At the petrol pump," the man had said on the phone, "in the pink house dress, the one I like." So behind the lace curtain, smiling, Asha wound around her body a silk sari in a tasteful black and white print. What she liked. The person she had become.
"You look good," said Manju upon consideration. "Better than that pink."
"Ooh-hoo, nice," concurred one of the eunuchs sullenly, as the new Asha stepped into the dark.
Chapter 17. A School, a Hospital, a Cricket Field. In mid-May, the election results came in. The reform-minded elites had not turned out to vote after all. Most of the incumbent parliamentarians were re-elected. They returned the prime minister to office, and the radical improvements in governance promised before the voting were quietly shelved. A few weeks later, the bulldozers of the airport authority began to move across the periphery of Anawadi. The beautiful forever wall came down, and in 2 days the sewage lake that had brought dengue fever and malaria to the slum was filled in, its expanse leveled in preparation for some new development. The slum dwellers consoled one another.
"It's not us yet, just the edges."
The demolition of airport slums would occur in phases over several years, so there was still plenty of time for the residents to unite to ensure that the businessmen and politicians who'd been buying up huts wouldn't be the only beneficiaries of the promised rehabilitation. In the meantime, the earth flattening at Anawadi's borders gave the children something to do. They stood where the sewage lake used to be, rapped as the bright yellow bulldozers churned the ground. The machines were unearthing the recyclable remainders of an earlier city, a suede Oxford, once white, rusty screws and other bits of plastic and metal. Saleable commodities, all. One Saturday afternoon, the little Husseins wandered out with Fatima's daughters to join other child prospectors at the edge of the site. As the children kept their eyes on the shovels, they debated what was going to be built on the newly reclaimed land.
"A school," someone said. "No, a hospital is what I heard it is going to be. One of those hospitals for babies being born? No, fool, what they're doing is for the airport, a taxi stand, and planes will come here also. That ground is too small for planes. They are making a place for us to play cricket only."
Fatima's younger daughter tensed. Something was gleaming at the edge of a new gash in the earth. She sprinted out toward a bulldozer, darting under a lowering shovel.
"Don't!"
yelled a woman passing by. The little girl did. Crouched and tugged, jumped back just in time to avoid getting clocked, and, after the bulldozer passed, squatted again to dig. It was a whole real something, a heavy steel cooking pot. She seized it and tore back to Anuwadi, beaming, her bare feet kicking up dirt clouds as she ran. The old pot was worth at least 15 rupees, and at the sight of it, two women in the Maidan began to laugh. From progress and modernization, at least one Anuwadian would make a profit. Fatima's daughter lifted her treasure high for all of her envious peers to see. A few weeks later, the children found a still more exciting diversion. Journalists bearing cameras with long black snouts. Suddenly, Anuwadi was in the news. The proximate cause was a cheerful, if illegal, June tradition. A Sunday afternoon horse and carriage race on the gleaming Western Express Highway. Small bets were placed, and people lined the highway to watch. The deposed slumlord, Robert the Zebra Man, was running two of his horses harnessed to an under-maintained carriage, freshly painted red and blue. Late in the race, as the pretty cart reached the crest of an overpass, one of its wheels rolled away. The carriage veered, harnesses broke, and the unnerved horses plunged off the bridge. A newspaper photographer was on hand to capture their grisly landing on the road below. And so began a campaign to find and penalize their negligent owner, Robert having fled the scene, leaving only a false address behind. Public outrage built, and newspaper headlines multiplied. On the dead horse trail, an exclusive investigation. Minutes after horse's death, cops knew about it. No case, even now. Exclusive, where the two horses lived before their painful death. One day, Sunil, Mirchi, and other children watched as activists from a group called the Plant and Animals Welfare Society, or PAWS, brought in the media and representatives of the city's Animal Welfare League for a raid on Robert's horse shed. Several horses were determined to be malnourished. Cuts and sores were found on painted zebras. The Animal Welfare League spirited the neediest of the beasts to a therapeutic horse farm. "Horses rescued," was the headline of the following day. The persistent activists then turned their attention to Robert's prosecution. The officers at the Sahar police station, having enjoyed a long, mutually profitable relationship with the former slumlord, declined to register a charge of cruelty to animals. "Culprit goes scot-free." So the animal rights group took its photographic evidence to the commissioner of the Mumbai police. Finally, the former slumlord and his wife were charged under the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act for failing to provide adequate food, water, and shelter to their four-legged charges. The forces of justice had finally come to Anuwadi. That the beneficiaries were horses was a source of bemusement to Sunil and the road boys. They weren't thinking about the uninvestigated deaths of Gullu and Sanjay. Anuwadi boys broadly accepted the basic truths, that in a modernizing, increasingly prosperous city, their lives were embarrassments best confined to small spaces, and their deaths would matter not at all. The boys were simply puzzled by the fuss, since they considered Robert's horses the luckiest and most lovingly tended creatures in the slum. The activists had been few in number, but working together, they'd made their anger about the horses register. At Anuwadi, everyone had a wrong he wanted righted. The water shortage, brutal for 3 months now. The quashing of voter applications at the election office. The worthlessness of the government schools. The fly-by-night subcontractors who ran off with their laborers' pay. Abdul was one of many residents who were angry at the police. Elaborate fantasies about blowing up the Sahar police station had become the secret comfort of his night times. But the slum dwellers rarely got mad together. Not even about the airport authority. Instead, powerless individuals blamed other powerless individuals for what they lacked. Sometimes they tried to destroy one another. Sometimes, like Fatima, they destroyed themselves in the process. When they were fortunate, like Asha, they improved their lots by beggaring the life chances of other poor people. What was unfolding in Mumbai was unfolding elsewhere, too. In the age of global market capitalism, hopes and grievances were narrowly conceived, which blunted a sense of common predicament. Poor people didn't unite. They competed ferociously amongst themselves for gains as slender as they were provisional. And this undercity strife created only the faintest ripple in the fabric of the society at large. The gates of the rich, occasionally rattled, remained unbreached. The politicians held forth on the middle class. The poor took down one another, and the world's great unequal cities soldiered on in relative peace. As the rains began in June, the new judge presiding over the trial of Kakashin and her father started calling witnesses. This judge, C.K. Dhiran, had bony hands and sleepy eyes behind his spectacles, and he ran through cases even faster than the first judge had. Approaching his courtroom, on the top floor of the building, Kakashin turned her head to a small window, where over an expanse of wet tile roofs she could make out the Arabian Sea. What was the point of trying to mind-read another judge? She was still weak from jaundice and tension, and as the weeks passed, it seemed futile to try to understand what was being said or to predict whether or not she and her father would go to prison. Her mother was worried enough for all of them, with her terrible dreams and her new habit of running across the Maidan in her sleep. Kakashin simply sat on the bench with the other accused people, and murmured prayers until she was free to join the rest of the family in devising new ways to make money. As Mirchi put it, they were now down to earn and eat. They had given up on the idea of restarting their garbage business in Sakinaka. The rent on the shed there had been greater than Abdul's monthly income. So Abdul now spent his days driving the rattle-trap three-wheel truck from slum to slum, looking for jobs transporting other people's waste to recyclers. Mirchi took the temp jobs he could find, in addition to discreetly trading garbage at Anawadi when the police were not around. Their younger brother, Atahar, dropped out of school, paid for fake papers that said he was of working age, and broke rocks on the road. Atahar said he didn't mind quitting school to help his family, but Kakashin minded, very much. On the last day of July, the prosecutor and the defender made their closing arguments. The judge looked at Kakashin for what seemed to her to be the first time and cracked a joke about her burqa.
Are we certain this is the accused? It could be someone else. Who can recognize her dressed like this?
When the judge finished laughing and the lawyers finished saying whatever it was they were saying to the judge, in English, the judge told Kakashin and her father to come back in 90 minutes. There would be a verdict. As they left the courtroom, the judge was saying,
Now I am only waiting for the pay hike to take effect, and then I should retire. Maharashtra is such a narrow-minded state. Only here they ask for the receipts and bills from judges. In Andhra Pradesh and Gujarat, the judge receives the petrol money along with the salary, without having to produce bills.
Outside the courthouse, a city garbage truck rolled over a dog. It yelped and died, and Kakashin and her father decided the courthouse canteen was a better place to wait. Kakashin sat on the floor and stared at her shoes, which were new and plastic and hurt her. When she walked back into the courtroom, she was limping and barefoot.
What do you do?
At the witness stand, Kakashin answered the first and last question that the judge had directed to her.
Housewife, she said.
She wasn't about to tell him about leaving her husband and the photos of the other woman in his cell phone.
And what is your business?
The judge asked Karam, who who had clasped his hands to stop them from trembling.
Sir, I am of plastics,
Karam replied. He thought it sounded better than of empty water bottles and polyurethane bags.
Well, because of you, the judge said, one woman's life is gone.
No, Saab,
Karam cried out.
She did what she did by herself.
The judge said nothing for a while, then looked to the prosecutor with a stiff orange comb over.
So what to do with these ones, then? Should I sentence them to 2 years or 3 years?
Kekashin froze. Then the judge smiled and held up his hands.
Go, leave them,
he said to the lawyers.
Jao, chordo.
He declared the Husseins not guilty. It was over. The judge's conclusion was succinct.
There is nothing on record to show that the accused in any manner instigated the deceased to commit suicide. Thus, prosecution has miserably failed to establish guilt against accused beyond reasonable doubt.
Move along now. The judge had other cases to hear and wanted to clear the witness stand, to which Kakashin and her father appeared to be glued.
You can go,
the defense attorney said a second time, more emphatically, and Kakashin and her father flew. Now only Abdul's trial in juvenile court, the judgment on his honor, remained. In September 2009, the clerk at the juvenile court said,
next month it is likely to start.
In October, the word was,
3 months' time, maybe.
A Sahar police officer whom Abdul kept running into at Dongri was at least consistent.
Admit you did those things to the one leg. There is a solution to everything. Your case will go on forever if you don't admit it, and if you do admit it, they will let you go today.
As 2009 drew to a close, Zerunisa was taking special measures to hasten Abdul's trial and vindication. She visited a Sufi mystic on Ray Road who specialized in improving futures, relieving tensions, removing curses, and appeasing ghosts, the latter an important part of the draw for Zerunisa, who thought Fatima's ghost might be behind Abdul's legal limbo. The mystic tied a red thread on Zerunisa's wrist and sent her to tie another red thread around a tree in a courtyard where her fellow pilgrims were spinning and chanting to drumbeats. The spirits would be friendlier now, the mystic had promised, taking the money. Still, Zerunisa thought it couldn't hurt to go to the mosque and do a manat in Abdul's name for 7 Fridays. As 2010 progressed and Zerunisa's efforts bore no fruit, the special executive officer of the government of Maharashtra resurfaced to suggest that money would start a trial faster than prayer. Zerunisa rewarded the suggestion with some of the finest curses she had ever invented. By the end of 2010, she and Abdul had concluded that a suspended state between guilt and innocence was his permanent condition. Abdul still looked for the master when he went to Dongri. He wanted to tell the teacher that he had tried to be honorable in his final years as a boy, but wouldn't be able to sustain it now that he was pretty sure he was a man. A man, if sensible, didn't make bright distinctions between good and bad, truth and falsehood, justice and that other thing. For some time I tried to keep the ice inside me from melting, was how he put it. But now I'm just becoming dirty water, like everyone else. I tell Allah I love him immensely, immensely. But I tell him I cannot be better because of how the world is. With 3 Hussein boys earning, the family was slowly gaining again, and when Anawadi was demolished, they believed they just might get one of the rehabilitation flats. 269 square feet for a family of 11, far from the airport and its garbage, but considerably better than pavement. Abdul grew dark only when he thought back to the start of 2008, his business thriving, the first installment made on a small plot of land outside the city. The Vasai plot had now been sold to another family, and the Hussein's deposit had not been returned. Abdul's father had developed an irritating habit of talking about the future as if it were a bus.
It's moving past, and you think you're going to miss it. But then you say, wait, maybe I won't miss it. I just have to run faster than I've ever run before. Only now we're all tired and damaged, so how fast can we really run? You have to try to catch it, even when you know you're not going to catch it, when maybe it's better just to let it go.
Abdul wanted no part of this malaise. Fortunately, he had hauling work to do. Early mornings, he would start humbling up to supervisors at sheds and large industrial slums.
Anything to take to the recyclers?
He was learning all the back roads and the spiny byways of the city, since three-wheeled vehicles like his own were barred from some of Mumbai's smooth new thoroughfares. There were days when he spent more on gasoline looking for work than he earned from commissions, but there were good days, too, humping down the road, his tiny truck overloaded with trash. There was no place he wouldn't go for money. The farther from Anawadi, the better. He went over the state border to Vapi in Gujarat. He went to Kalyan, to Thane. But mostly he stayed in Mumbai. Driving his circuit late at night, he sometimes imagined not returning to his family in a slum he now thought of as just another kind of prison. Imagined pressing forward and disappearing into some distant, perhaps better, unknown. Eventually, though, his city would jerk him back to his senses. The buses and SUVs barreling toward him, swerving. The children stepping obliviously from the roadsides into traffic, as Fatima's daughter was always doing, as if they didn't know the value of their lives. "One mistake at the wheel and it will finish me," Abdul would complain to his mother upon the inevitable return to Anawadi. "It's so much tension out there, the mind cannot wander. Every second you have to be alert." In truth, he felt powerful moving through midnight traffic, his tired eyes narrowed to pinpoints. If there was no mastering this vast winking city, he could still master a few feet of gummy road. Early one morning, Abdul was perched on a black garbage bag by the video shed, contemplating another fruitless trip to Dongri and the anything-to-move routine of the evening to follow, when Sunil nestled into the garbage bag beside him. They hadn't seen each other in a while, with Abdul away driving. Sunil leaned in close, as an almost friend will sometimes do.
"Lend me 2 rupees for something to eat?"
Abdul reared back.
"Ugh, talking to me so close and you haven't washed your mouth. It's horrible. And your face, go wash your face. I get scared just looking at you."
"Okay, okay, I will," Sunil said, laughing. "Just got up."
"Early for a thief."
"Not doing that anymore."
Garbage prices had been inching back up. Police beatings had been intensifying, and security guards at the airport had stripped him naked and shaved his head. Sunil had decided to return to scavenging. In fact, this decision to scavenge was why he was sitting with Abdul on a garbage bag on the road. The Tamil who owned the game shed was angry at the loss of Sunil's stolen goods and wouldn't let him sit there anymore. The Blinky boy, Sonu, had almost forgiven Sunil for becoming a thief, but not for his habit of waking after dawn. Sunil wanted to join up with Sonu again and was working on the early rising. He was also developing a formula for not hating himself while doing work that made him loathsome to his society. Erase X worked, Sunil had discovered, but not for very long.
"Always I was thinking how to try to make my life nicer, more okay, and nothing got better," Sunil said. "So now I'm going to try to do it the other way. No thinking how to make anything better. Just stopping my mind. Then, who knows? Maybe then something good could happen."
Abdul swatted him.
"I lose my head listening to you," he said.
He felt old, sitting next to someone who still had ideas. When the slum got demolished, they'd probably never see each other again. Sunil wanted to start his life over somewhere outside the city, where there were trees and flowers. But Abdul thought it likelier that Sunil would end up sleeping on city pavement. These last days of Anawadi might be the best days Sunil would get. A large glossy leaf gusted across the road and landed at Abdul's feet. The filth in the air had barely browned it. He reached for it, took a rusty razor blade from his pocket, sliced the leaf into tiny pieces, then blew into his palm. Green confetti settled on Sunil's eyebrows, in his lashes, and on top of his rough-shorn head.
"So what now?"
asked Sunil after a minute.
"What now? So wash your mouth and go to work. Already you're late. What's going to be left on the ground at this hour?"
"Okay, bye,"
said Sunil, jumping up, brushing off the leaf bits and starting to run. Abdul watched him go. Weird and decent kid. He wished the boy luck, and half an hour later, Sunil would find it, on a narrow ledge high above the Mithi River. Soon, the taxi drivers who littered this ledge with garbage would be pushed elsewhere, as the new airport fulfilled its talismanic role, becoming an elegant gateway to one of the 21st century's most important world cities. But for now, 11 cans, 7 empty water bottles, and a wad of aluminum foil rested on a long spit of concrete, awaiting the first child with the courage to claim them.
Hello, this is Catherine Boo. 10 years ago, I fell in love with an Indian man and gained a country. He urged me not to take it at face value. When I met my husband, I'd been reporting for years from within poor communities in the United States, considering what it takes to get out of poverty in one of the richest countries in the world. When I came to India, an increasingly affluent and powerful nation that still housed one-third of the poverty and one-quarter of the hunger on the planet, parallel questions persisted. I quickly grew impatient with poignant snapshots of Indian squalor, those ribby children with flies in their eyes and other emblems of abjectness that one can't help see within 5 minutes of walking into a slum. For me, and I would argue for the parents of most impoverished children in any country, the more important line of inquiry is something that takes longer to discern. What is the infrastructure of opportunity in this society? Whose capabilities are given wing by the market and a government's economic and social policy? Whose capabilities are squandered? By what means might that ribby child grow up to be less poor? And another set of questions nagged about profound and juxtaposed inequality, the signature fact of so many of our modern cities. Some people consider such juxtapositions of wealth and poverty a moral problem. What fascinates me is why they're not more of a practical one. After all, there are more poor people than rich people in the world's Mumbais. So why don't places like Airport Road, with their cheek-by-jowl slums and luxury hotels, look like the insurrectionist video game Metal Slug 3? Why don't more of our unequal societies implode? I wanted to read the book that would begin to answer some of my questions, because I felt I couldn't write it, not being Indian, not knowing the languages, lacking a lifetime of immersion in the context. I also doubted my ability to handle monsoon and slum conditions, especially after several years of lousy health. I made the decision to try in the course of an absurdly long night at home alone in Washington, D.C. Tripping over an unabridged dictionary, I found myself on the floor with a punctured lung and 3 broken ribs in a spreading pool of Diet Dr. Pepper, unable to slither to a telephone. In the hours that passed, I arrived at a certain clarity. Having proved myself ill-suited to safe cohabitation with an unabridged dictionary, I had little to lose by pursuing my interests in another quarter. A place beyond my so-called expertise, where the risk of failure would be great, but the interactions somewhat more meaningful. I'd felt a shortage in nonfiction about India, of deeply reported accounts showing how ordinary low-income people, particularly women and children, were negotiating the age of global markets. I'd read accounts of people who were remaking themselves and triumphing in software India, accounts that sometimes elided early privileges of caste, family wealth, and private education. I'd read stories of saintly slum dwellers trapped in a monochromatically miserable place. That is, until saviors, often white Westerners, galloped in to save them. I'd read tales of gangsters and drug lords who spouted language that Salman Rushdie would envy. The slum dwellers I'd come to know in India were neither mythic nor pathetic. They were certainly not passive. Across the country, in communities decidedly short on saviors, they were improvising, often ingeniously, in pursuit of the new economic possibilities of the 21st century. Official statistics offered some indication of how such families were faring, but in India, like many places in the world, including my own country, statistics about the poor sometimes have a tenuous relation to lived experience. Although I had no pretense that I could judge a whole by a sliver, I thought it would be useful to follow the inhabitants of a single unexceptional slum over the course of several years and see who got ahead and who didn't and why, as India prospered. There being no way around the not-being-Indian business, I tried to compensate for my limitations the same way I do in unfamiliar American territory, by time spent, attention paid, documentation secured, accounts cross-checked. The events recounted in the preceding pages are real, as are all of the names. From the day in November 2007 that I walked into Anawadi and met Asha and Manju until March 2011, when I completed my reporting, I documented the experiences of residents with written notes, video recordings, audio tapes, and photographs. Several children of the slum, having mastered my flip video camera, documented events recounted in this book as well. Devu Kadam, one of Manju's former pupils, was an especially passionate documentarian. I also used more than 3,000 public records, many of them obtained after years of petitioning government agencies under India's landmark Right to Information Act. The official documents, from the Mumbai Police, the State Public Health Department, the State and Central Education Bureaucracies, electoral offices, city ward offices, public hospitals, morgues, and the court, were crucial in two ways. They validated in detail many aspects of the story told in these pages. They also revealed the means by which government corruption and indifference erase from the public record the experiences of poor citizens. When I describe the thoughts of individuals in the preceding pages, those thoughts have been related to me and my translators or to others in our presence. When I sought to grasp, retrospectively, a person's thinking at a given moment, or when I had to do repeated interviews in order to understand the complexity of someone's views, very often the case, I used paraphrase. Abdul and Sunil, for instance, had previously spoken little about their lives and feelings, even to their own families. I came to my understanding of their thoughts by pressing them in repeated, they would say endless, conversations and fact-checking interviews, often while they worked. Although I was mindful of the risk of overinterpretation, it felt more distortive to devote my attention to the handful of Anuadians who possessed a verbal dexterity that might have provided more colorful quotes. Among overworked people, many of whom spent the bulk of their days working silently with waste, everyday language tended to be transactional. It did not immediately convey the deep, idiosyncratic intelligences that emerged forcefully over the course of nearly 4 years. When I settle into a place listening and watching, I don't try to fool myself that the stories of individuals are themselves arguments. I just believe that better arguments and maybe even better policies get formulated when we know more about ordinary lives. While I spent time in other slums for comparative purposes, I chose to focus on Anuadi for two reasons. Because of the sense of possibility there, as wealth encroached on every side, and because its scale was small enough to do door-to-door household surveys, the vagrant sociology approach. The surveys helped me start to differentiate between isolated problems and widely shared ones, like the disenfranchisement of Anuadi's migrants in Hijras. My reporting wasn't pretty, especially at first. To Anuadians, I was a reliably ridiculous spectacle given to toppling into the sewage lake while videotaping and running afoul of the police. However, the residents had concerns more pressing than my presence. After a month or two of curiosity, they went more or less about their business as I chronicled their lives. The gifted and generous Marin Ranaday made this transition possible. She was my translator in the first 6 months of this project, and her deep intelligence, scrupulous ear, and warm presence allowed me to come to know the people of Anuadi, and for them to come to know me. Kavita Mishra, a college student, also translated ably in 2008. And beginning in April of that year, Unnati Tripathi, a brilliant young woman who had studied sociology at Mumbai University, joined the project as a translator. She was skeptical of a Westerner writing about slum dwellers, but her attachments to Anuadians proved greater than her reservations. She quickly became a fierce co-investigator and critical interlocutor. Her insights litter this book. Together, over the course of 3 years, we wrestled with the question of whether days in rat-filled Anuadi garbage sheds and late-night expeditions with thieves at a glamorous new airport had anything to contribute to an understanding of the pursuit of opportunity in an unequal, globalized world. Maybe, we firmly concluded. I witnessed most of the events described in this book. I reported other events shortly after they occurred, using interviews and documents. For instance, the account of the hours leading up to Fatima Sheikh's self-immolation and its immediate aftermath derives from repeated interviews of 168 people, as well as records from the police department, the public hospital, the morgue, and the courts. As I reported this and many other aspects of the narrative in which facts were hotly contested, I found Anuadi children to be the most dependable witnesses. They were largely indifferent to the political, economic, and religious contentions of their elders, and unconcerned about how their accounts might sound. For instance, Fatima's daughters, present during the arguments that ended with their mother's burning, were consistent in their exoneration of Abdul Hussein, as were other Anuadi children on whose sharp eyes and wits I had learned over time to rely. being present for events or reporting them soon afterward was crucial. Since his years passed, some slum dwellers recalibrated their narratives out of fear of angering the authorities. Their fear was not irrational. Sahar police officers sometimes threatened slum dwellers who spoke to me. Other Anawadians rearranged narratives for psychological solace, giving themselves, in retrospect, more control over an experience than they had at the time. It was considered inauspicious and counterproductive to dwell on unhappy memories, and Abdul spoke for many of his neighbors when he protested one day. "Are you dim-witted, Catherine? I have told you 3 times, and you put it in your computer. I have forgotten it now. I want it to stay forgotten. So will you please not ask me again?" Still, from November 2007 to March 2011, he and other Anawadians worked extremely hard to help me portray their lives and dilemmas. They did so even though they understood that I would show their flaws as well as their virtues, and with the knowledge that they wouldn't like or agree with everything in the book that resulted. I feel confident in saying that they didn't participate in this project out of personal affection. When I wasn't dredging up bad memories, they liked me fine. I liked them more than fine. But they put up with me largely because they shared some of my concerns about the distribution of opportunity in a fast-changing country that they loved. Manju Vagakar, for instance, spoke frankly about corruption in the hope, however faint, that doing so would help create a fairer system for other children. Such choices, given the socioeconomic vulnerability of those who made them, were simply courageous. Just as the story of Anawadi is not representative of a country as huge and diverse as India, it is not a neat encapsulation of the state of poverty and opportunity in the 21st century world. In every community, the details differ and matter. Still, in Anawadi, I was struck by commonalities with other poor communities in which I've spent my time. In the age of globalization, an ad hoc, temp job, fiercely competitive age, hope is not a fiction. Extreme poverty is being alleviated gradually, unevenly, nonetheless significantly. But as capital rushes around the planet and the idea of permanent work becomes anachronistic, the unpredictability of daily life has a way of grinding down individual promise. Ideally, the government eases some of the instability. Too often, weak government intensifies it and proves better at nourishing corruption than human capability. The effect of corruption I find most under-acknowledged is a contraction not of economic possibility, but of our moral universe. In my reporting, I'm continually struck by the ethical imaginations of young people, even those in circumstances so desperate that selfishness would be an asset. Children have little power to act on those imaginations, and by the time they grow up, they may have become the adults who keep walking as a bleeding waste picker slowly dies on the roadside, who turn away when a burned woman writhes, whose first reaction when a vibrant teenager drinks rat poison is a shrug. So how does that happen? How, to use Abdul's formulation, do children intent on being ice become water? A cliche about India holds that the loss of life matters less here than in other countries, because of the Hindu faith in reincarnation, and because of the vast scale of the population. In my reporting, I found that young people felt the loss of life acutely. What appeared to be indifference to other people's suffering had little to do with reincarnation and less to do with being born brutish. I believe it had a good deal to do with conditions that had sabotaged their innate capacity for moral action. In places where government priorities and market imperatives create a world so capricious that to help your neighbor is to risk your ability to feed your family, and sometimes even your own liberty, the idea of the mutually supportive poor community is demolished. The poor blame one another for the choices of governments and markets, and we who are not poor are ready to blame the poor just as harshly. It is easy from a safe distance to overlook the fact that in undercities governed by corruption, where exhausted people vie on scant terrain for very little, it is blisteringly hard to be good. The astonishment is that some people are good, and that many people try to be. All those invisible individuals who every day find themselves faced with dilemmas not unlike the one Abdul confronted, stone slab in hand, one July afternoon when his life exploded. If the house is crooked and crumbling, and the land on which it sits uneven, is it possible to make anything lie straight?
This is Sunil Malhotra. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity by Catherine Boo. This program was directed by Danny Campbell, executive producer Janet Stark, Text copyright 2011 by Catherine Boo. Production copyright 2012, Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.